Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be with you, Dennis.
Laura, we have so many things to talk about on this broadcast, so many things. Among them, all those Republican presidential hopefuls who came to Iowa this past weekend, the state legislature passing a sweeping education bill, and the state House and Senate passing dueling property tax cut bills. But we start tonight with a U.S. Supreme Court decision last Friday that affects women in Iowa and across the nation. Laura, take it from there.
Yes, this was in response to the Texas case where the judge in Texas had ordered a suspension of the FDA's approval of mifepristone. That is a medication used in most medical abortions, also used in miscarriage care. It was approved for that use in the year 2000, but a Texas judge had put a hold on that. And the Fifth Circuit had largely upheld limits on the use of mifepristone. But the U.S. Supreme Court said late Friday in a decision with no explanation that for now, this opinion from the Texas judge is going to be on hold while the Fifth Circuit considers the case. And then eventually when the Supreme Court decides whether to hear that case, I think most people expect that they will. So this means that the status quo, mifepristone remains available nationwide under the current rules that the FDA allows. And again, it is used in most medication abortions. And the medication abortions account for about 80% of abortions in Iowa and more than half of abortions nationally.
Abortion providers in Iowa are saying that they have another option available no matter what happens with mifepristone.
Yes, currently the main regime for a medication abortion right now is first a dose of mifepristone, followed by one or more doses of misoprostol. Misoprostol can be used alone for medication abortion, and in fact, in some countries, that is the standard practice, but it's mostly the OBGYNs in the United States feel that it's more effective to have the two drugs in combination. But providers in Iowa and in many other states are stockpiling misoprostol, which is much more widely available and is not really under any realistic threat. And so if the U.S. Supreme Court upheld that Texas decision and undid the FDA approval of mifepristone, there would still be an option to have terminating pregnancies using misoprostol alone.
And one more note on abortion, payment for emergency contraception for nearly 70 sexual assault survivors in Iowa has yet to be made, all because of something that Attorney General Brenna Byrd is doing.
Yes, and I've been seeking records on this, but this was a story. Iowa Public Radio was able to get records from the Attorney General's office that showed that we already knew that Brenna Byrd had put on hold this longstanding policy that the Victim Compensation Fund, which is not taxpayer funded, it's funded by criminal penalties and fines, that was compensating victims of sexual assault and many other kinds of crimes for various medical costs, including a cost associated with needing emergency contraception or, in rare cases, abortion care. I had asked for a copy of that policy. The policy has not been formally changed. Brenna Byrd is apparently working on a rewrite or reconsidering the policy, but the previous policy remains in effect. It does say that emergency contraception and abortion can be covered, but for now, Brenna Byrd has put a halt to that. And nearly 70 sexual assault survivors who have had emergency contraception are waiting to be reimbursed for that. There are many other kinds of medical expenses that can be reimbursed through this victim compensation fund, everything from a treatment for lots of different kinds of injuries, even acupuncture, chiropractic care. So it's a pretty broad-based fund, but this seems to be the only area that Brenna Byrd is really taking a hard look at.
All right, it's on to Capital Week's Caucus Almanac. If you weren't with us last week, why the heck weren't you? But this, when we debuted the title of this Caucus Almanac, we're going to use this every week now because the Republicans are going to hold first in the nation caucuses, presidential caucuses next year. The Democrats, who knows what they're going to do. And this past weekend, oh my, GOP presidential candidates flocked to Iowa and talked about abortion, transgender care, schools. And this was all at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition event in Clive, a big deal indeed, Laura.
It really was. And this is the kind of event, we've talked about this before, with the Republican Party having the first in the nation caucuses and the Iowa Democratic Party not being in that early state window, and also the Democratic nomination not looking very competitive. Republicans have such a big organizing advantage with presidential candidates in the state almost every week. But this was a much larger than usual event. This was the kind of event they often call them cattle calls, where many candidates from the front runners to the long shots come and speak. This is a group, the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition, is one of the most influential social conservative groups. And so almost everybody wanted to be there, with the exception of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
And we're going to bring it down to three issues that they talked about. The first, abortion, as you would expect. Former President Trump was not there in person. He did a video report to them, and he pledged to stand against what he called the extreme late-term abortionists in the Democratic Party. That was his thing, but everybody else, they were pretty much on board.
Yes, and President Trump really emphasized his record, that he appointed hundreds of federal judges. He appointed three Supreme Court justices who are responsible. I mean, it's undisputed that without Donald Trump's appointees, Roe v. Wade would not have been overturned. And he reminded the audience of that and everything that he had done. I mean, the social conservatives, they know that Donald Trump is not an avid churchgoer. He's not someone who's always lived a pious life, but he is someone who can say to them, I have delivered. And the Associated Press reporter Tom Beaumont just published a story a few days ago about pastors in Iowa being very open to Donald Trump, some already supporting him, most open to supporting him, and largely because of this record related to abortion.
Trump would very much like abortion to be handled at the state level, and that led to some criticism from a somewhat unlikely source. Former Vice President, his Vice President, Mike Pence, said he would certainly support any pro-life legislation that came before him if he were president, and he criticized the former president for not being open to federal restrictions on abortion.
Yes, so Mike Pence is really trying to carve out a niche for himself, and this is one of the few issues where he can distinguish himself from most of the rest of the field, because most of the Republican candidates have talked about abortion being returned to the states for regulation, which is what the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision said. But Mike Pence has said that he would sign bills, he would sign a federal ban, he would do whatever he can. He understands that not everybody agrees with him on that, but he touted his record when he was in Indiana and his record as vice president. And I think he's trying to get some traction there. I didn't see a sign. He wasn't that warmly received, frankly, by the crowd. I mean, it was, I wouldn't say it was a hostile reception, but he didn't get the kind of applause that some of the other candidates did.
And one of those candidates who believes abortion should be handled at the state level, Vivek Ramaswamy. Now, he said in an interview with the Register that abortion is, in his words, murder, and that murder is regulated at the state level. I've never heard it quite put that way.
Yes. Well, and I thought that he gave a very dynamic speech at the event. He was the youngest candidate in the field. He said he's the first millennial to seek the Republican presidential nomination. He did focus, because of it was the Faith and Freedom Coalition, he focused a lot on religious issues. He had some quotes from scripture in there. And I wanted to mention that last week, it came out that Vivek Ramaswamy has hired the former Iowa Senate president, Jake Chapman, and also Jake Chapman's former assistant are going to be working for his campaign. And I thought that was a strong signal that he's going to really be competing for this social conservative group. And Jake Chapman was one of the people who was most involved in passing that 2018 abortion ban that would ban, if it's allowed to go into effect, that would ban almost all abortions in Iowa.
And on the issue of transgender care, the former president, Mr. Trump, had, again, one of those blowtorch quotes, and I'm quoting him now. He said, the left-wing gender lunacy being pushed on our children is an act of child abuse and will stop immediately if he's reelected.
Well, and this is an interesting thing, because when Donald Trump was president, this issue of transgender care, gender transition, it wasn't as dominant. And it's a real example of how sometimes the issues that are in the media, and I don't mean just like the mainstream media news reports, but what's going on conservative websites, talk radio, alternative sources, they've been emphasizing these transgender issues so heavily. And so you see most of these candidates talking about it. And I mean, I don't remember Donald Trump really talking about this issue, but all of a sudden, yes, he said that he would put a stop to gender affirming care for children. He said he would not allow biological men to compete in women's sports. And it wasn't a set of issues that he championed when he was president.
And we have often talked about the Lindmar School District in this discussion over these past weeks, and Mike Pence focused on them. He lambasted the school district in Iowa, Eastern Iowa, for their policy that allowed transgender students to request accommodations without parental consent.
I want to say one thing, and we've mentioned this before, the Lindmar School District policy is not unique. Lots of school districts in Iowa have very similar policies about supporting the students and their gender identity expression. So, but for some reason, the Lindmar, I mean, I think partly it was that they adopted a new policy during an election year and it attracted a lot of attention. It's the home school district of U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson. That gave it some attention. But Mike Pence's PAC spent some money on this issue. There's a lawsuit ongoing right now. It's pending before the Eighth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals related to Lindmar's policy that was filed by some parents. But for some reason, yes, Lindmar gets a lot of attention for this policy. And then Mike Pence has brought it up before. He actually did an event in Marion in the Cedar Rapids suburbs earlier this year.
And not to be outdone, Asa Hutchinson, the former Arkansas governor, recalled instructing Arkansas schools not to let transgender students use bathrooms that aligned with their gender identity. So LGBTQ, that's just a negative thing for the Republicans, as is education in general.
Well, this could potentially be a very awkward issue for Asa Hutchinson. It didn't come up. This was a friendly format on Saturday night, so it didn't come up. But I do expect at some point Iowa social conservatives to notice that when he was the governor of Arkansas, he vetoed the attempt to ban gender-affirming care for minors. It was the first state legislature to pass that. He vetoed that bill. They overrode his veto, and that law is on hold. There's a federal lawsuit that right now is pending in federal court. But, I mean, he sure didn't want to bring that up before that audience. That, by the way, he stopped because this is a law that Iowa's law is very popular here. It's something that a lot of Republican governors are trying to do. And I think that that's something that he's going to have to figure out how he's going to deal with questions about that.
And we can quickly, I think, go over the issue of education. Every speaker expressed deep skepticism about schools and a variety of issues. And Donald Trump, again, with a quote that everybody remembers, to retake schools from what he calls the radical left.
Well, and I thought it was funny that Perry Johnson and Vivek Ramaswamy got a big applause line when they said they would eliminate the U.S. Department of Education. I felt that like that was kind of a throwback to campaigns from the 1980s and the early 1990s. I remember Republicans campaigning on that. The U.S. Department of Education is one of the relatively newer agencies. It was created in the Carter administration, but it's been a while since Republican candidates tried to put that front and center, but that was something that the crowd at the Faith and Freedom Coalition was very receptive to.
I remember when Rick Perry was the governor of Texas, and during a debate, he said he was going to get rid of three agencies in federal government, but he couldn't remember what the third one was.
That's right. That was unfortunate. I felt for him. That could happen to anybody.
Yes. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis did not show up at this event, but he's coming to Iowa.
He is. He was in Washington last week. He met with U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, among other members of Congress, and he's going to be in Iowa at Representative Feenstra's annual picnic. That's in Sioux Center, way up in the northwest corner of Iowa. That's, of course, a critically important area in the Iowa Republican caucuses because it is such a high concentration. Sioux County routinely votes 80-85% Republican, and it's just people are well organized up there. So DeSantis has made some pretty big staff hires in Iowa, and he seems to indicate that he wants to compete. He's going to have to show that he can work the room and spend some time talking to people. On his previous Iowa visit, he didn't really mingle with a crowd, and that's something he's going to have to get used to doing if he's going to be a serious contender here.
And very quickly, President Biden is set to announce his reelection campaign as soon as tomorrow, Tuesday, if you're listening to us live on Monday night. Democrats are not enthusiastic about it. Most Americans don't want him to run, but the Democrats don't seem to have an alternative.
They don't. And I mean, the one thing that I would say is probably encouraging for Biden's team is I've seen this reinforced in several national polls. I haven't seen any Iowa polling on it. But if you ask the people who disapprove of both Donald Trump and Joe Biden, who they would support in that kind of a matchup, Biden is way, way ahead among the voters who say they disapprove of both people. So there seems to be more strong disapproval of Trump, and Biden's approval ratings are certainly not great at this stage of his presidency. But I think that against Trump, you'd have to say that he's fairly well positioned right now.
And one more quickie before we do a cutaway here. Tucker Carlson, the highest rated cable television host in cable news, fired by Fox News on this Monday, on the same day that Don Lemon is fired by CNN. Tucker Carlson was a thorn in the side of Democrats. He traipsed in conspiracy theories, replacement theory. He was considered almost a demon on cable news if you're a Democrat.
Yes, but that's not why he was fired. He was fired because of the material that came out during the lawsuit that was settled last week, the Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit against Fox News that is going to cost the network $788 million. And I thought it was interesting that that is why he was shown the door. And he certainly didn't seem to expect it. I watched a recording of just the last bit of his show on Friday, and he said, we'll be back on Monday and see you then. So they didn't give him a chance to go on the air and say goodbye to his millions of viewers. And he really did have millions of viewers on a regular basis.
Highest rated cable host in primetime, absolutely. One more quick note, Don Lemon gets fired after he inappropriately and ridiculously said that Nikki Haley was not in her prime because she was too old. Nikki Haley running for president is 51 years old.
Yes, and she, other than Vivek Ramaswamy, I think she's about the youngest person in the Republican field. So this came up in the context that she had said that people running, politicians who are older than 75 should have to do some kind of competency test, and that's a controversial idea. But then for Don Lemon to say, I mean, it's just not an appropriate thing to say about somebody anyway, but to say that a woman is not in her prime because she's in her 50s, I mean, that was ridiculous, and in some ways it's surprising he wasn't fired until today.
It is 16 and a half after the hour, and you are in tune with an extended edition of KHOI Radio's Capital Week. Extended because we want to bring in my longtime buddy, Tom Beal, whom I could say many kind things about, but instead I'm just going to let you do all the talking, Tom, about how people can help support this radio station. Tom, you're never going to get fired, okay? I want you to know that.
Oh, fudge, you stepped right on my line. I was going to ask you, too, if you could tell me what was the big difference, what is the big difference between KHOI and other broadcast organizations? And, you know, one obvious answer would be we don't have advertising, but we also don't fire our news people. Well, a lot of drama there in the other channels, and fortunately, our drama is pretty quiet around here. Right now, we're focusing on talking to our listeners and asking them to step up and make a contribution to the station. We don't have advertising, as we've said before, so we're listener-supported, and that means we need our listeners to support the station and the programs like the one you two are doing tonight. So you may have received a letter from KHOI. We hope that you opened it and took a look at it because it's an interesting and informative little report on what we're doing, but it also asks you to make a contribution. Often people do that in the form of a membership, and we have a very basic membership of $60 a year. Many people take larger positions and make a greater donation, and their membership is enriched even greater. Others just make a straight outright donation. And we appreciate, however you go about it, we appreciate it. Now, one easy way to support the station is to send back the letter. There's a little letter inside the letter, and send it back to the station with your contribution. Or you can go online at khoifm.org/membership, and that will walk you through the steps to make a donation online. Well, this has been a very interesting week politically, and I always enjoy listening to your summary and analysis of what's happening, because frankly, it is confusing. And you folks do such a wonderful job of explaining what's happening out there so we can kind of make sense of it all, if that's possible in the case of modern politics. So once again, if you support this program and if you support KHOI, please go online, khoifm.org/membership, and make a contribution. We will really appreciate it, and it will help ensure that this great program and others like it can continue. So back to you folks.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. We'll be back to you in just a few minutes. Laura, let's start talking about what the state legislature did last week. And boy, they did a lot of things last week. Perhaps the biggest thing, they passed a sweeping, I use that word advisedly, I use it intentionally, a sweeping education bill that limits instruction on so many things, including gender identity, sexual orientation. It removes school books. Let's start going down what that happened and what it means.
This was a really important bill, and if you had to sum up the Iowa legislature's 2023 session, one of the major themes has been reshaping public education in Iowa. Remember, for 2 years in a row, the governor was not able to get her school voucher plan through the legislature. She also was not able to get what was called a transparency bill finalized. And so this bill that was finalized last week is the outgrowth of that. Originally, it was supposed to be school transparency, and it grew into something much, much bigger. And I'm sure that the governor will be eager to sign it. It has almost everything she asked the legislature for.
Exactly. The Senate passed it 34-16, Republicans in favor, Democrats opposed. The House passed it 57-38, 4 House Republicans joining all Democrats in opposition. The governor will sign it. Let's go down quickly what it does. First thing, bans school books, bans them with a description or visual depiction of a sex act.
Yeah, so the governor's original proposal, remember, was that there would be a statewide removal list. And if any school district anywhere in the state removed a book from the school library, it would go on this list. And then in any other district, parents would have to sign written permission to have their children read the book. The Senate and House Republicans decided this was too cumbersome. So they just came up with a new definition of age appropriate, that everything in a school library and classroom has to be age appropriate, and age appropriate does not include anything with a description or a visual depiction of a sex act as defined in Iowa code. Now, the House had amended this bill a few weeks ago to add the word graphic, that this would ban books with a graphic description of a sex act, and the Senate took out that word graphic. So this is pretty broad. It is going to probably sweep up a lot of works of classic literature. I mean, Lord of the Flies, 1984. There are a lot of books that are maybe not explicit, but they do have descriptions of a sex act. And so school libraries are going to have until January of next year to implement this and get these books out of the library. And it'll be interesting to see how many districts face some kind of challenge over this.
And they're going to be removed from Iowa's K-12 schools. But another part of this bill bans instruction relating to gender identity or sexual orientation from K-6 grade.
So this is an idea that Governor Reynolds took from Governor DeSantis in Florida, the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, which in Florida was from kindergarten through third grade. The legislature expanded this to make it K-6. All instruction relating to gender identity or sexual orientation. Democrats have expressed a lot of concern about how broadly this would be interpreted. If a teacher is in a same-sex relationship and has a picture of their partner or spouse on their desk, as people often do in a classroom, would that be considered inappropriate instruction on sexual orientation? I mean, there are lots of questions about how this is going to be implemented, but this is something the governor wanted and the governor has received.
It also requires schools to notify parents if their children request to use a new name or pronoun in schools.
Yeah, so the schools, first of all, if school staff are going to use a name or a pronoun that's different from what's on the registration materials, there has to be written parental consent. And if a student at school asks for an accommodation, such as using a different name or different pronouns, the school staff have to notify the administrators, and the administrators have to notify parents or guardians. Now, the original version of this bill that the governor introduced had an exception that said if school staff think that could lead to a dangerous situation, that the school could notify the Department of Health and Human Services about possible child abuse or something. All of that got taken out of the bill. So there is no exception, and Democrats raised a lot of concerns during the debate over this final version of the bill last week, that this could put some children in unsafe situations if their parents are not supportive or guardians, and if the school notifies them that the student has asked for an accommodation.
And the bill also says that parents have a constitutionally protected right to make decisions affecting their children, including religious and moral upbringing, education, and medical care.
Yeah, so this is a new thing that the Republicans are adding to Iowa code. This is similar to the original wording that the governor suggested, but if anything, the legislature strengthened the wording. They said that it's a fundamental constitutionally protected right, and that any and all restrictions of that right would be subject to strict scrutiny. Strict scrutiny being that highest bar for the government to clear. If somebody challenges a law or a policy, the government has to show that they have a compelling interest in the policy and that the policy is narrowly tailored to meet that interest. Now, one interesting thing about this paragraph in the bill is that it includes an exception for that the law that was already enacted last month banning gender-affirming care for Iowans under age 18. And I've talked to people in the LGBTQ community, I've talked to some attorneys about this, and certainly that law is going to be challenged in court at some point. And this new provision in the code that says parents have a fundamental constitutionally protected right to make decisions for their own children, this may be brought up in that litigation.
And briefly, the bill also lets parents transfer their child to another school in the same district if the child is bullied, and it removes the requirement to teach about AIDS.
Yes, the currently mandatory curriculum on human growth and development and sex ed does say that schools for junior high and high school, they have to start teaching about sexually transmitted infections, including AIDS and HPV and the HPV vaccine. That's been in code for many years, and that is coming out of the code. It's not a ban on teaching those subjects, but it is no longer mandatory. And so what that's going to mean is that many school districts will continue to keep that in the curriculum, but in some school districts, perhaps to avoid controversy or just to save time, they probably won't be teaching specifically about AIDS and HPV. The HPV vaccine is considered to prevent several kinds of cancer, and Iowa does have fairly high cancer rates, particularly of the oral and throat cancers, which are among those that the HPV vaccine can prevent.
Now, not to confuse you, but the House passed another education bill, sending it to the governor. It's a little different. It's a lot different from this first one. Let's briefly talk about this other bill.
So this one is what the Republicans are calling the flexibility bill. The one that we've just been talking about for the last several minutes, they call the parental empowerment or the parents' rights bill. This one is supposed to be giving school districts more flexibility. And the way it accomplishes that is by loosening the requirements for who can be hired for certain roles as educators, and also the requirements for curriculum that has to be offered. And the Senate floor manager, Senator Tim Kreinbrink of Fort Dodge, he was explaining that there's a real divide between urban and rural school districts, and that some of these ideas, he claimed, came from superintendents in rural districts where they just have trouble. They don't have the resources. It's harder for them to hire qualified people. So, for instance, one part of this bill says that school librarians no longer have to be licensed as educator librarians. They can be anybody who has worked in a public library, and they may not even need to have a bachelor's degree for that. Also, teaching in the classroom, people would not necessarily have to have a specific K-12 teacher's license. Somebody who is an adjunct teacher at a local community college could come in and teach some subjects at a high school, for instance. That was part of it. In terms of the curriculum requirements, high schools currently are required to offer 4 years of foreign language. That is going to drop to 2 under this bill. They dropped a requirement that schools have a special class on financial literacy. They dropped a requirement for technological literacy. And generally, this is something also for fine arts. They reduced the number of fine arts offerings that school districts have to have. Probably this is not going to affect the larger districts like Ames and the Des Moines Metro districts, but in rural school districts, those with fewer than 1,000 students, probably those, especially in high school, they're going to have fewer options.
And the governor will sign these, and when she does, we will report on it on Capitol Week. Now, the House and the Senate last week passed dueling bills to cut property taxes. No, don't tune us out. We're going to keep it so simple. We're not talking tax levies. These are controversial. We know this. Laura and I know this. Laura, in 65 seconds, simply, what do these bills do?
So the House and the Senate, both of these bills passed almost unanimously, only one dissenting vote in each chamber, but they are very different approaches toward the same goal of lowering Iowans' property taxes. The House bill is simpler. It cuts the levy for related to a school funding schools by $1 for every $1,000 in property valuation. So if your house is worth $150,000, your property tax bill goes down by $150. If your house is worth $200,000, your property tax bill is going to go down by $200. This bill, the House proposal, would have the state backfill that money that the school districts would lose. It would cost the state about $200 million a year, and it would pretty much benefit all property taxpayers equally. For the most part, it also has a limit on how much local governments can increase your property taxes. So assessment, if your home assessment goes up by 20 or 30%, your property tax bill could still only go up by 3%. Now, the Senate side is a little bit different. First of all, it's only about $100 million in estimated tax relief as opposed to $200 million on the House side. And it's not equal for all taxpayers. There will be certain extra exemptions for veterans and seniors also, but they do complicated things with the levies that I'm not going to get into. But the point being that the Senate and the House are both really excited about their property tax proposals, but these would not be easy to combine into one bill. And I think that if anything delays the end of the legislative session, it's going to be this effort to find an agreement on what they do about cutting property taxes.
It was about 90 seconds. Not bad, Laura. Very nice. Let's take a deep breath right now. It is half past the hour, whatever hour you're in whatever time zone. This is KHY's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, and Samuel on Laura's lap right now. She's doing this broadcast. I see. Hi, Sammy. How you doing? We are your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. Now, we're going long tonight. Yes, we are. So we can bring you messages on the need to support this community radio station. Important messages. Once again, my friend Tom Beal, who has some key words on how you can help support KHOI. Thomas?
Thank you, sir. I'm reminded of an old story that no person's home, life, or fortune is safe as long as the legislature sits. anyway, in regards to KHOI, your fortune is safe, but we hope you'll share some of it with the station because this is a community-supported station. We ask our listeners to twice a year step up and make a contribution so we can pay our bills and so we can keep on broadcasting these excellent programs. I have to tell you that I'm fascinated by the information you're providing tonight about the legislature's actions. I would not have understood all that without your background, and I appreciate your taking the time to lay that out for us, and I hope our listeners appreciate it too. And if you do, please go online, khoifm.org/membership, and make a contribution. Become a member or just make an outright donation. The money will be well and carefully spent, I assure you, and it will ensure that the station can continue to provide programs like this one. So once again, this is our spring membership weeks, I should say, and we ask you to go online, khoifm.org/membership, and make a contribution. Thanks again, and back to this superb program.
You are very kind, Tom, and we'll hear from you again a bit later in the broadcast. Laura, we're going to blast our way through the rest of this broadcast with what else the Senate did last week and what else the House did. One of the things Senate Republicans did last week is employ a new strategy in the wake of an unflattering state Supreme Court decision. They're just not talking a lot anymore.
We talked about this a few weeks ago, this Iowa Supreme Court decision. This was unusual. They enjoined part of a budget law that had been enacted at the very end of the 2020 session. They said that it was an example of log rolling, and they cited extensively quoted from the Iowa Senate debate that happened in the middle of the night on that last night of the session. And so this, I mean, nobody could recall anything like this happening. Late night, Monday night, a Democratic senator asked the bill's floor manager of a child labor bill to yield to some questions, and he said no. And they took a break. The Democrats went to caucus. When they came back, he asked him again to yield. He said no. The Democrat asked the Senate Majority Leader, Jack Whitaker, to yield, and he said no. And this then caused the Democrats to call for another caucus, and it delayed proceedings for several hours. They didn't end up passing this bill until close to 5 in the morning. But the Democrats were just outraged by this again, people who, reporters who have covered the legislature for decades, had not seen anything like this, with a floor manager and members of the majority party refusing to answer questions about the bill. And they said that they don't want to run into problems if the Iowa Supreme Court is going to suddenly be using quotes from Iowa legislative floor debate in their rulings.
All right. The Senate, when they did talk, sent the governor a bill setting a $5 million limit on the non-economic damages a victim can win in court as a result of an accident involving a trucking company. This was the second part of the tort reform that the Governor Reynolds wanted.
So this was one where the big question, the Senate passed a bill in early March that was much more favorable to trucking companies. It was a $2 million cap on non-economic damages. It applied to many more kinds of commercial vehicles. It had a much broader liability exemption for trucking companies if their one of their employees caused an accident that catastrophically injured or killed people. And so this went to the House, and they had a lot of trouble getting this bill through the House. So they had to change it, and what ended up passing the House was much more of a compromise. So again, the cap went up to $5 million, as you said. Also, it's a much narrower kind of vehicles. It's mainly semi-trucks, larger trucks. It doesn't include this broad scope of agricultural vehicles and lots of other commercial vehicles, vans that were covered under the Senate bill. And also, in terms of the liability protection, the trucking companies would be shielded from lawsuits based on the liability and hiring the driver, but not based on if there was negligence in their supervision or training or of the driver and that led to an accident, the trucking company could still be sued. So this was a compromise, and a lot of people weren't sure whether the Senate was going to take this compromise, but as it turned out, they did. They accepted the House amendment and they sent it to the governor. This is something the governor mentioned, tort reform, in her condition of the state speech in January. So there's no question that she is going to sign this bill. And I also want to mention that while many states do have limits on non-economic damages in lawsuits generally, Iowa would be the only state to enact a law that specifically protects trucking companies.
And the Senate also passed changes after that all-night debate you were talking about to Iowa's child labor laws that lets 14 to 17-year-olds work longer hours and in restricted fields. Now, this generated the absolute wrath of the Washington Post this weekend in an editorial. Stephen Colbert on his Late Show ripped Iowa. We're in national headlines.
Yes, this is one of a bill that has been pursued. Arkansas was the first to enact it. I think some other Republican-controlled states are working on it. There is an outfit out of Florida. Their lobbying arm is called the Opportunity Solutions Project, and they've been active in Iowa for a few years. And this is one of their babies that they've been working on. But also the Restaurant Association and the grocery industry is very interested in this law as well. And Iowa Workforce Development, the state agency, was involved in working out some of these provisions. So the bill that the Senate passed is not as it's not as far-reaching as what was initially introduced early in the session. So the initial bill had much more, it had liability protections for employers if children were to get injured or killed on the job, and lots of things that it had more dangerous occupations that were allowed. This bill was scaled back a little bit. The main thing is that it allows 14 to 17-year-olds to work longer hours. They can work later shifts. That's something that the restaurant owners really want, that they right now during the school year, teenagers can only work until 7 p.m. and then during the summer only until 9 p.m. So this bill would push that back so that during the school year they could work shifts until 9 p.m. and during the summertime they could work until 11 p.m. There would also be some other, I mean, there are some other small parts of it, but those are some of the most controversial things. And Democrats are very against this bill. Labor unions are very against it. And a lot of groups, they say that this is going to put teenagers who don't have well-developed judgment and risk assessment, they're going to be in dangerous situations. More of them are going to get hurt. They're going to endanger some of their colleagues. And also, this bill would let 15 and 16-year-olds serve alcohol in restaurants. And that's something that is very controversial as well.
Laura, let's move down to the part where the Senate passed a constitutional amendment last week that would establish that the lieutenant governor who ascends to the governor's office, as Governor Reynolds did, has the power to appoint a new lieutenant governor behind them. Some people might say, well, wait a minute, she did that, didn't she?
She did. This is something I worked on a lot in 2017. So it turns out that on the previous occasions when a governor left office before the end of his term, the lieutenant governor assumed the powers of the governor's office, but did not technically become the governor. The way the Iowa Constitution is written, the powers of the governorship devolved onto the lieutenant governor, but that person was not technically the governor and did not have the power to appoint a successor. And in fact, in the four times that it happened previously, that person did not appoint a successor. Well, Kim Reynolds, when she became governor in 2017, when Governor Terry Branstad, after he was confirmed as U.S. ambassador to China, she wanted to appoint a lieutenant governor. And there was a big controversy because the Democratic Attorney General at the time, Tom Miller, issued a very thoroughly researched opinion that said, no, under the Iowa Constitution, she really doesn't have the power to do that. So what she did was she appointed Adam Gregg. They did call him lieutenant governor. In my reporting, I referred to him as acting lieutenant governor because that's technically what he was until they were elected in 2018 and inaugurated in 2019. He was acting lieutenant governor. But yeah, so this cleans up the language and makes clear that if a governor dies, becomes incapacitated, leaves office for any reason, that the lieutenant governor would become governor and would have the authority to appoint a new lieutenant governor.
As you say, she appointed Adam Gregg, and he said, because there was some controversy, he would not assume the governor's office if she stepped down, that then Senate President Jack Whitmer would take over.
Yes, that's technically the line of succession in the Iowa Senate. Again, they did routinely refer to him as the lieutenant governor in all of their official communications and when he was introduced at public events. But technically, he was, prior to the 2018 election, he was just acting in that role as lieutenant governor.
And the Senate last week approved several more of Governor Reynolds' appointments to Iowa commissions.
Yes, they've started moving really quickly on these, actually. They were moving through a lot of these Wednesday and Thursday of last week. Most of them are not controversial. Typically, in the Iowa legislature, I mean, the Iowa Senate, it confirms hundreds of appointees every year, most of them unanimously, maybe with one dissenting vote, and a handful become controversial. And the difference this year is that for the first time, Republicans have 34 of the 50 seats. That's that two-thirds majority that they need. So for the first time, Democrats don't have the power to block any of the governor's appointees. In the past, they have often blocked one or two or three people a year. So what happened last week, Craig Paulson was unanimously confirmed to head the Department of Management. Mary Moseman, the former state auditor whom Rob Sand defeated in 2018, was unanimously confirmed to head the Department of Revenue. There was also a unanimous vote for Lanny Zeman, who was Attorney General Brenna Byrd's choice to lead the Office of Consumer Advocate. That's a rare position that's appointed by the Attorney General, not the governor. And the Senate confirmed two new members of the Iowa Utilities Board and two new members of the Iowa State Racing and Gaming Commission, but only some of those were more partisan votes. So Eric Helland, that was a more controversial one. 11 Democrats voted against him. Most of the Democrats voted against Alan Ostergren, who is a well-known conservative attorney, to be on the racing and gaming position. And the Kristen Stifler, who's a former Republican candidate for the Iowa House, she was confirmed just barely as executive director of the Civil Rights Commission. But again, that was a party line vote. The Democrats actually had asked to defer on that confirmation. They said they had questions about it. And the Republican majority, this is where elections have consequences. The Republican majority said, we're not deferring, we're voting her through. And they had the votes and they did it.
So you might be saying, in fact, I can hear you saying out there, listeners, Dennis and Laura, Laura and Dennis, you're talking about the Senate. Didn't the House do anything last week? Oh, my, yes. They voted 55-41 to pass a bill restricting the state auditor's access to information and the ability to go to court. And this is a big deal. And Rob Sand, the auditor, doesn't like it.
Yeah, Rob Sand's not the only one who doesn't like it. Yeah, six Republicans voted against that. I thought that was a fairly strong statement. That's unusual. This is a bill that originated in the Senate in early March. It came out of nowhere, really, the amendment that would greatly restrict the state auditor's ability to access information from other agencies. Government agencies would basically have to decide if that was something that he needed to see for an audit or that his staff needed to see. And also, it would eliminate his ability to go to court to enforce a subpoena. And it would put that in, there would be an arbitration, but it's not like an arbitration that you might think that has just an independent person deciding. This would be a three-member arbitration board where one person would be appointed by the agency being audited, one person from the state auditor's office, and the third would be appointed by the governor. And so this would basically mean that if Rob Sands' staff were trying to audit any branch of the Reynolds administration, then the governor could use her appointee on this board, this arbitration board, to say, no, you can't see that material, and he wouldn't be able to go to court. So Rob Sand held a press conference. He said this is the most pro-corruption bill we've ever seen. It's going to lead to waste, fraud, and abuse. A number of organizations representing national organizations, representing CPAs and state auditors, have expressed concern that this bill could put Iowa's federal funding at risk because the state auditor has to audit Medicaid, student loan funds, all different kinds of federal funding that is used by the state of Iowa. And if the auditor no longer has free access to that information and needs to get permission basically from the audited agency, that could be a problem. So the House did amend the bill somewhat, but it didn't change the substance of the bill in any meaningful way. And most people expect the Senate will take up this bill, pass the House amended version, and send it right on to Governor Reynolds this week.
Don't go away. There's still a bit more to come. We're on an extended edition tonight of Capital Week, 15 minutes now before the top of the hour, and you are in tune with KHY's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart. Want to bring in Tom Beal one more time now. Tom, I'd love to bring you in 10 more times, but we're going to run out of time. You have a message on how you can help support this radio station. It's a good message, and you're a good man to bring it. Here you go.
Well, thank you, Dennis. And there is so much to cover. I'm glad you have a little extra time this week to do the overview of all the things happening in the legislature. Well, your program is one of other programs that we provide that provide information you can't get anywhere else. So we hope you as a listener value this program and these other shows that we carry and are willing to support the station and these programs by making a contribution. This is the time of year to do it. So you go online, khoifm.org/membership, and it will walk you through the steps to make a donation to the station. And I hope that you got a letter from us and that you will look it over. And if you, if we've convinced you that this is something worth supporting, you'll put a check in the envelope and send it back to us. Or if you'd rather go online, khoifm.org/membership is the way to go. And we, I assure you, we will spend the money carefully and faithfully, and we will appreciate it very much. So thanks, Dennis and Laura, for this superb program. I'm eager to hear the rest. So carry on.
Look forward to seeing you in person in just a few weeks. I think we have a dinner date. Well, apparently we don't have a dinner date because he's not responding. Well, he was going to buy anyway, so what the heck. All right, Laura, we have a few minutes left here to talk about what else happened or could happen. The Iowa Public Information Board is hoping to secure passage of legislation that would require government agencies to promptly acknowledge public records requests. Well, my, this has a lot to do with the state Supreme Court decision that involved a few public entities, including you.
I want to say, first of all, I really do hope that listeners will go online or respond to that letter and donate to KHOI. I really enjoy doing the show. I think we cover a lot of issues that people can't hear anywhere else. There's so much other diverse programming on the station, and they do it all with a shoestring budget. So I just wanted to put in that plug myself. But yes, this bill that the Iowa Public Information Board proposed, it passed the Iowa House unanimously in February, and it got through a subcommittee in the Senate, and it didn't get through a Senate committee in time for that second funnel deadline, but it's technically still eligible for debate because it's on that unfinished business calendar. I'm not hearing that there is any political will to bring this to the Iowa Senate floor. I would be fairly surprised if they do, but this would be important not just for reporters like me, but for other people who want to make public records requests. It would say that the records custodian from the government body has to acknowledge your request, has to tell you right away, I'm the person who will be handling it. Here's approximately how long it will take. Here's approximately how much it will cost to compile the records and ask any clarifying questions. And what has happened in a lot of, not just in state government, but in local government as well, is people will submit a records request and it will just get ignored for weeks or months. And it's very difficult to be in that situation as the requester. So I will be surprised if anything like this happens this year, but it is, it technically it is eligible for debate still in the Iowa Senate.
And last week, a coalition of anti-hunger groups urged Governor Reynolds to veto that bill that would subject Iowans to a new set of asset tests to receive food benefits. It is on her desk. I don't think she's going to veto it.
No, I don't think there's any chance that she will veto it. These asset tests for Iowans on federal food assistance, that's called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This is something the Iowa Senate has been trying to do. The big advocate for it is that Florida-based organization, the Opportunity Solutions Project. The Iowa Senate has passed bills like this several years in a row. Prior to this year, those bills always died in an Iowa House committee. But Governor Reynolds did signal in a budget bill that she introduced in 2021, she did signal that she was on board with this approach to an asset test. That didn't happen in 2021, but even though she hasn't spoken publicly about the bill this year, her office has already communicated that this is the kind of thing that she would like to see. The asset test, the way the bill is written, it only applies to the SNAP program, but there are other eligibility and verification requirements that apply to Iowans who are on Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. And the fiscal note that was prepared by the Iowa Legislative Services Agency, they estimated that thousands of Iowans will lose their food assistance and thousands will lose their Medicaid. I mean, it's hard to predict how it will play out, but other states that have enacted laws like this have seen many people who were eligible lose their benefits. And so that's why the anti-hunger groups and many organizations, frankly, dozens of organizations were lobbying against this bill. But I don't think there's any realistic chance that the governor would veto it.
Laura, the legislature hopes to adjourn by this Friday, April 28th. They still have to work on a budget bill for next year. What do you think? This is your prediction time now, the crystal ball. Are they going to adjourn on Friday?
I really don't think so. I mean, it can't be ruled out. I think that they'll be still passing some bills next week, into next week. I think they will adjourn sometime next week for the year. The Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer has apparently been telling people that he expects the Senate to be done with all of their business this week. The Iowa House and Senate leaders did agree last week on budget targets. That's for the various areas of the budget. Neither chamber has passed any of the budget bills, but supposedly that is going to start happening in the Senate tomorrow. They're going to start moving budget bills with actual dollar amounts in them. The Iowa House did not have any floor debate today and is not scheduled to have any floor debate tomorrow. So I just think it would be a really tall order for both chambers to pass all of the budget bills this week. There's still cleanup. Again, the Senate hasn't taken up that amended version of the state auditor bill. The House hasn't taken up the child labor bill. Neither the House or the Senate has passed that Iowa caucus regulation bill that we talked about last week. And then the property taxes, which we talked about in the earlier segment of the program, they still have to agree on that. So, I mean, it is theoretically possible that they could do all that by this Friday, but I sense that they will still be working on some of those bills next week.
All right. We have about 4.5 minutes left. I want to get through a couple of topics here. About 50 students and Democratic lawmakers this afternoon, Monday afternoon, as we go live on Monday night, marched around the Capitol chanting, "No more silence, end gun violence." It's all about a bill that would let Iowans keep guns in their locked cars in the parking lots of schools. What do you think about that protest? Any effectiveness at all?
Well, I mean, the Republican majorities have not tended to pay a lot of attention to protests. I mean, there have been many protests of the bills that addressing transgender Iowans earlier this year. As we mentioned, the bills about the food assistance, there were other protests with that. This is another one, by the way, that still needs to happen before they can adjourn. The House approved this bill last week, and this one would allow, as you mentioned, it would allow people to keep loaded firearms as long as they were locked in their vehicles and not visible. They could be in most public parking lots, in parking lots on school grounds and college campuses as well. The Iowa Senate has not taken up that bill. It's eligible for debate because there's a companion bill in the Senate, but they have not taken up the House version. I do expect that to pass since it is a priority of the Iowa Firearms Coalition, which is an affiliate, the state affiliate of the National Rifle Association. But again, it hasn't been debated yet in the Senate.
And you wrote a piece on whether the Iowa State Legislature can expel a lawmaker. This in the wake of what Tennessee did in expelling two lawmakers a couple of weeks ago. They are now back in the legislature there. Can Iowa do this?
Yes, the Iowa Constitution has a provision that's very similar to Tennessee's Constitution that says either chamber of the state legislature by a two-thirds vote can expel one of their own members. My next question was, has it ever happened in Iowa? I couldn't find any record that it happened, so I turned to the staff of the wonderful Iowa Legislative Services Agency, and they researched the issue, and they found that, no, they looked up literally going back to the territorial legislature before Iowa was even a state. They looked at everybody who left the legislature before their term ended for one reason or another, and nobody has ever been expelled from the Iowa legislature. Technically, the Iowa Senate, there is that two-thirds Republican majority already. So in theory, they have the votes to expel a Democratic member. The House, they're a few seats short. They have 64 seats. They would need 67 to expel a member. I don't expect anything like this to happen here. When there is a breach of decorum on the Iowa House or Senate floor, what typically happens is that the lawmaker is not recognized to speak or the microphone is cut off. And I mean, I think in an extreme case, it's possible that somebody could be escorted from the chamber, but I would be really surprised to see anything like that Tennessee scenario playing out here. And I think that a lot of Republicans realize now that with all of the national media coverage on the Tennessee situation, that probably that was something that backfired on the Republican majority there.
And in just the last minute, we want to say goodbye to somebody. Somebody we've talked about on this broadcast over the years because he talks politics on WHO-TV. Dave Price has been the station's political director on Channel 13 for years. He announced last week he's leaving.
Yes, and earlier this year, WHO announced that they were discontinuing the program The Insiders, which is the political interview show, the Sunday interview show. And full disclosure, I've been on that show a couple of times myself, but just must-see TV. And really unfortunate, I think it's going to be a big loss in the local media landscape, especially with all of these Republican presidential candidates coming in and out of the state. I mean, I don't know how many interviews Dave Price has done over the years with presidential candidates, but it's a lot. And so, I'm not sure. He hasn't announced what his next move is. I wish him the best of luck in his next adventure.
And Laura, you have done this entire show with Sammy the dog on your lap. I have been impressed the first time that's happened in nearly 2.5 years of doing the show. It's magnificent. You were both great, and you both are going to be busy this week as the legislature winds down.
That's right. He was very quiet. So, yes, he's it's better to have him on my lap and quiet than possibly barking at a squirrel or a deer in the yard.
And 15 seconds again, you say you don't think they're going to adjourn, but you weren't really positive on that. You said it's a possibility.
I mean, it is possible, but I just think that they're not going to be able to wrap up work on all these bills, and particularly the property taxes. And they still, I mean, it takes time to debate the budget bills. The Democrats can offer amendments. I mean, it's not something that they can just pass in 10 minutes, even if the leadership agrees that these are the numbers that they want. So I think it'll take some time, and I expect that they'll be adjourning sometime May 2nd, 3rd, 4th, around that range.
Okay, well, we're out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura Bell and I are going to catch our breath now. After all, we have been talking a long time tonight. We're both going to be back next Monday night at 7 for our regular edition of Capital Week. We'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics, Iowa style. And as always, we hope you can join us. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We value it. Between now and next Monday night at 7, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week.